So tonight's talk, which apparently is going to be a little shorter talk, has to do with experiencing and understanding and working with strong states of mind. And it starts, or the way that I'm going to start it, is around dealing with consciousness. It focuses on two different suttas. The first one is the sutta of Maluka-putta, which is one of the senior monks of the original Sangha, and a discussion between the Buddha and him. And the other one is the Kuma Sutta, or the Tortoise Sutta. And this is a sutta that is written kind of in the, it's like a little story, almost like Aesop's fable, and it deals with the relationship between a jackal and a tortoise. Okay. So I'm going to start with a brief little story, but I think it's a really important story about consciousness. It doesn't seem that way originally, and you have heard undoubtedly some version of the story in the past. So the story is that there are two monks from different monasteries, and they meet on a riverbank, and they start talking, and, you know, tell me about your monastery, and tell me about your monastery, and you know, they start comparing notes, and then it gets to, you know, well, my teacher, you know, the abbot, and so the one monk says, the first monk says to the second monk, well, tell me about your, you know, your teacher, and the monk says, well, he says, you know, my teacher can remember all of his former lives. And he can foresee the deaths and the rebirths of anyone that he meets, and he can read people's minds, and he can create a second body and be in two places at once, and he can make his body so light that he can walk on water. Yeah. Pretty impressive lineup. and depending on historically what school and what have you, those are all qualities of an awakened being. You know? So I saw that Diane's going to give a talk on what is an awakened being, and for me the test just is now, you know, like if anybody even gets close to trying to make that claim, I just create a big water puddle and ask them to walk across it. Can they be light enough to walk across that thing? So you know, the first monk is like, wow, you know, that's pretty impressive. And so the second monk says to the first monk, well, what, you know, kind of like puffed up chest, well, you know, like, what can your teacher do? You know, top that. You know? And so the first monk says, well, you know, my teacher, I mean, like, my teacher is really incredible. I mean, my teacher does these spectacular things. And the other monk says, well, like what? And he says, well, when he smells, he just smells. And when he hears, he just hears. You know? And when he tastes, he just tastes. And when he feels, he just feels. And when he has a thought, he thinks just that thought. He doesn't add anything on to any of this. You know? And the story stops at that part. I'm always interested in what the other monk's reaction was to that. So this is a kind of a humorous and an important little story, because it goes to the issue of consciousness from the Buddhist perspective, and probably more importantly, what are we doing with our consciousness? You know, I mean, like, what's reasonable to expect? And I'm one of my real fascinations with the Buddhist teaching is to the degree that we can figure it out. What was it that immediately preceded the Buddhist teachings, because so many of his teachings are in reaction to major cultural and religious and spiritual trends in Indian culture at the time that he thought were leading people into suffering and dependence. And so you can see in so many cases how his teaching is an absolute 180 degree of another major teaching that was present at the time. So at the time, you know, there wasn't, Hinduism didn't exist at the time of the Buddha, but the Vedic tradition that had been around for thousands of years and eventually has this mammoth literature that gets put into writing, and it's beautiful. Much of it is beautiful, and much of it is exquisite in the sense of very precise description of mind states of the kind that the Buddha would do. It's very helpful. But there is this seminal difference between that whole tradition, which eventually morphed into Hinduism. And on this one thing I'm going to mention is actually part of Hinduism, that separates the Vedic tradition, the Hindu tradition, and the Buddhist tradition with respect to this issue of consciousness, and as a result, with respect to the issue of practice. Okay. So in the Vedic tradition, in the Upanishads, which you probably heard about, the notion of consciousness is that consciousness arises outside of us, and it is the product of an immaterial being or presence in the universe, and that we get to share that consciousness. So this consciousness is pre-existing, and then we take advantage of it, and that the consciousness itself has a particular purpose, and the purpose is to practice in such a way that through multiple lifetimes, and in Hinduism they use the term transmigration. You will never hear that term in Buddhism. Migration, trans across multiple lifetimes, right? It's a transmigration of a soul. A specifically identifiable soul that moves through various physical presences and then eventually merges with Brahman, this consciousness. Okay, so Sri Ramakrishna, who I really love, and I'm prone to quote, even though on this point it's a big difference, but he's talking about this form of consciousness, and he said, "It is to know God, it is to know Brahman, distinctly by realizing his existence through an intuitive experience and to speak to him intimately." So I think that's beautiful and poetic, and it's a little different than what we talk about here. I mean, you could hear that, right? Okay. So the Buddha came along, and the Buddha said, consciousness is not outside of us, and it's not dependent on something that's out there, that there is a consciousness, and you know, if whatever that is isn't there, we can't be conscious. He said that there is an organic, sense-based, entirely human process that leads to the arising of what? Human consciousness. Okay?
Would you say that again slowly?
I'm going to try to say it in a number of different ways. Okay. So the Buddha said that there is this organic, meaning that it's here, okay, sense-based or body-based human consciousness. Okay. It's not a supernatural consciousness. It's not the consciousness of some other being that we're sharing, and that it arises from this body, and specifically the sense doors, the five sense doors, traditionals, and the six sense doors of the Buddhist notion that the mind itself is a sense door. And it means it in two different ways, that The mind is a sense organ in the sense that it actually experiences pleasant, unpleasant, pleasure, and pain. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've all had the experience of our mind being like, it just feels like it's so tight, you know, where the mind is so agitated that it's painful, right? We've had that. And times when you're joyful and happy, and you're just thinking nothing but joyful and happy thoughts, and you just like, it actually feels different, not just your body, but your mind. Okay, so one is that it's a sense organ in that sense, and the other, a sense organ in the sense that something connects with it and consciousness arises, which is thought. So how consciousness arises from a Buddhist perspective is that there is a sense door that is working. Okay, that is working, and it comes in contact with an object, and that could be, you know, if it's touch, it's the chair. If it's smell, it's an odor that hits the sense organs. If it's sound, it's sound. And when those two meet, a third thing happens. And that third thing is that consciousness arises. And so the thing that's so fascinating is that the Buddha's notion, and this is important to hear from a practice perspective, is not that consciousness arises, you know, like this big consciousness that's holding everything. It's that ear consciousness arises, and then eye consciousness arises, and then mind consciousness arises. And in the same way I was saying earlier, is that these all of these things are arising and passing away in response to conditions, so that there's not the idea that there is, you know, a single unitary consciousness, which is kind of what Western psychological thought is based on. That is not Buddhist thought. And this is significant, because Buddhist thought is it's arising and disappearing in relationship to things coming together. So if they're not coming together, that consciousness isn't there. So you can have, we were saying anger earlier. Well, is anger a single thing? No, it's not. And when your mind and your ability to discern starts to become more sophisticated, you see that, well, I'm angry. There's anger, 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 fear, 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 anxiety, anxiety, loneliness, loneliness, and then maybe I just check out, right? It's too much, and my mind just checks out for 10 minutes. And there's a question of whether you're even conscious from a Buddhist perspective at that point. Okay. But the idea that mind states are unitary and that there is one big unitary consciousness arises is not the model. And the reason that that's so important is that if I can train myself to watch for consciousness arising from my eye, and consciousness arising from my ear or hear, that how I understand things, and particularly strong states of mind, starts to completely change. Is this working so far? Right. So the notion that, man, you know, I'm depressed. Anybody who's had depression over several period of time in their life, and I put myself in that basket, knows how difficult and frightening and all kinds of things depression is, right? If your model of depression is that it's this unitary thing, so it's like a blanket that's just laying over everything in your life, I mean, it's pretty hard. I mean, even the model is, how do I get out from under this blanket? You know, whatever you want. But if the idea is that as bad as it seems, depression is arising moment to moment in relationship to the conditions. And it's probably not every moment depression. It's probably other things. And then you start to look for those, then you get a foothold of how you can get out of depression. This is the reason that this is so valuable, so critical. So I just want to do a little experiment right now. Once again, you don't have to get in any special position, but we're just going to test this. So I just want you to close your eyes for a minute. And I'm just going to say a series of short things, and I just want you to watch your experience and see what happens, okay? Think about a child, or your child, or your grandchild. And let that image just settle. Go back to your breath. Think of someone you love. And then just let that settle. Think of someone that you really, really don't like. Okay, let that settle. Go back to your breath. Donald Trump. Okay, let that settle. The bombings in Paris. Okay, let that settle. Go back to your breath. And then when we finish here now, I'm going to call on one of you. Okay, let that settle. You can open your eyes. Okay. So what happens when we do that? I mean, does something actually arise when there's an idea put out and there's a moment of contact? Does something happen? No. I mean, obviously, right? Yeah, it happens right away. And was it happening the moment before?
No.
No, it wasn't happening the moment before. And then here's the really interesting question. Did the mind stay with just the initial experience that arose, or did it start to go into other things? It tends to go into other things, right? Which is the difficult part. Okay. So the whole idea behind this, and then this sutta we're going to go to, is that the Buddhist notion of consciousness is at this original moment, which is happening over and over and over again all the time. And it's the reason, how many people have had the experience in their life where you're going along and you just go, oh my God, I can't believe that. And you suddenly see something that you've been working with maybe for years, and suddenly you see it in a totally new way, right?
Absolutely.
Almost everybody, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how can that happen? Right? I mean, like in a single moment, boom, right? Like everything looks different. That's the beauty and the hope of Buddhist practice and understanding consciousness in this way, that at any moment that is possible. At any moment that we could actually wake up and be mindful, that's possible. And that's the reason the Buddha said that, you know, like a moment of mindfulness is worth, I don't know how many years of being unmindful. Because in that moment, everything can change. So one way to think of this is that it's like a canvas. This moment of this original experience, the initial experience, whatever you want to call it, that we're trying to get to as often as we can, that it's like a canvas. It's like, boom, this big canvas is put up, and that's the starting place. And then something happens, and you can see that thing on the canvas, okay? And the first and important part of it is that I can tell the difference between the canvas and the thing that just went up on the canvas. Okay. Eye consciousness arose. Right. And I mean, one of my favorite exercises with this is unless I'm really looking for something and I know what I want, I'm not much of a shopper. You know, it's not like I can go to the mall and some people just love to go to the mall and spend hours, and I go out of my mind. they have to sedate me to agree to do that. So what I'll do is that I'll just, like at the Arden Mall, I'll just get on one of those benches and I'll just say, okay, I'm just going to watch 10 feet. I'm just going to keep my eyes there. And then I just sit there really relaxed and I just watch people walking by. And I'm not so much looking at the people as watching what happens when they walk by. Okay, so it always blows my mind because, you know, I kind of have this idea of myself of being, you know, kind of a, I guess, a semi-awake person and, you know, being, you know, a semi-kind person. And the reactions are something like this, you know, like, oh, that's a ridiculous hairdo. You know, like, what a stupid outfit. You know, what a fat person. Yeah, it just goes on and on. You know, it's like, where are all those thoughts coming from? Right? But the cool part about it is that, like, okay, it's just 10 feet. I'm not watching the people. That's not what it's about. I'm watching my mind. So there's this spacious peace. You know, the consciousness arises, and what I'm looking for is what gets put on the consciousness, what gets put on the canvas. So being able to see those two different things is the whole game, right? I mean, this is what mindfulness is about. So if I'm thinking that each one of those people walking by is a moment of consciousness arising, right? And it is, because my eye is touching that image and it's arising. So, I mean, this is an exciting way to understand this. It's like, well, my consciousness is arising all the time, right? No, it's not just, well, there's consciousness. It's like, no, it's arising all the time. And if I can see that difference, I have a choice. And if I don't see that, if either I just think it's big consciousness or I'm unmindful, that's what the sutta says, well, then I'm lost. But if I can see the canvas from what's getting put on the canvas, then I've got this big, big chance of waking up. Okay? So I'm going to talk just a little bit about the sutta because I don't want to go over. But that piece right there, you know, where we work down to this idea about, well, you know, before I said Donald Trump, you weren't thinking about Donald Trump, and then say Donald Trump and what happens? Right? All these things. You know? If they weren't there before, right? And they're there because of a moment of contact. I mean, it's just so clear, right? And so it all filters down to this idea of if we can be present and we can have a model in our mind that consciousness is arising all the time, and that not to buy into our assumptions about mind states. You know, I'm angry, I'm frustrated, I'm depressed, I'm whatever. Those are all true. I'm not saying, you know, don't acknowledge that. But if you adopt this, well, let me watch and see, you know, what's actually there. Inevitably, once you start to do that, you will see that something other than just anxiety or just fear or just depression is there. And the minute you see that, it makes you start to feel different about what you're experiencing. You know, the moment before, I thought I'm just like lost in depression. And now I realize all kinds of stuff is coming up. You know, maybe if I look at that rather than being depressed about being depressed, you know, maybe there's a path out, right? You know. So I think another reason I like this is I believe that you need to be creative to be a good Buddhist practitioner. You know, you need to see these and like, be curious enough to like, well, yeah, what actually is it? You know, and you start with the premise, no, it's not just depression. See, I mean, it's turn it on its head. That's what the Buddha was always doing. No, it's not just depression. No, it's not just anger. No, it's not just anxiety. Okay, well, if that's the case, what is it really? Because then that opens up the possibility for my mind to frame everything and experience it in a different way. So, next time we're going to go through this sutta, and it's fascinating because these suttas are laid out in a number of different structures, and this one starts off with a request by a senior monk, and then a section called questions. And sometimes the questions are from the Buddha, and sometimes the questions are from the person who made the request for the teaching. Okay. And then there is instruction, which is basically taking the questions and putting them into a structure. And then there is the result, like what happens if you practice this way. And then in this, there's what they call the verses on... what's the first one? There's verses on dispassion, which is the verses on passion and verses on dispassion. And that basically has to do with if you're not mindful, this happens. And if you are mindful and follow these instructions, this happens. So initially it looks like this very kind of repetitive, structured sutta. And then if you understand that structure and where it's going, you know, you really kind of start to get curious. And it really becomes fascinating. And for me, this is one of them. So we're going to go through each one of those, and then we're going to add on to it, using add on in a positive way, the Torts Sutta. So these are cited in the little e-news. And if you have time or you have the interest and want to call up and look at the two suttas, they're radically different kinds in terms of how they're presented. But it might be helpful, and if you've ever had any thought about, well, gee, I'd like to learn how to read a sutta, this would be a good starting place. So take a look at the sutta, and then we'll take it apart next time and talk specifically about how to apply it. Okay. So we've got time for just a couple of comments or questions if you've got them. Yeah, great.
I was thinking, the book you was reading for How Can I Help group, she talked about that, and that's what I've been kind of working with for the last 2 weeks is, like, I'm angry. She was suggesting to reframe it to anger's arising, and then, like, hurt's arising, and then she was talking about reframing it as, I'm not angry, it's like this... whatever the emotion is rising rather than I am. And that's been huge for me.
Yeah.
And it has been easier to go, I'm angry, I'm hurt, I'm feeling alone, or it's easier to break it down than saying I'm angry. When I say that to myself, I feel locked in or stuck.
Yeah, so to some degree it depersonalizes it, right?
It depersonalizes.
What Brian's referring to is we have this year-long course going on called How Can I Help, and we're using two texts. And one is How Can I Help by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman, and the second one is by Joanna Macy that I had mentioned in the pre-session comments, called World as Lover, World as Self. And it, World as Lover, World as Self. And it's a fascinating book, and this is kind of an abbreviated version and a little more community-friendly version. The first one that came out in the 90s was very, very dense. She's a real intellectual, and that first version radically changed my understanding of this whole issue we're talking about right now. I read that. And it helped me understand dependent origination in an entirely new way. And I can, you know, look back and at markers where things changed for me in practice, and that was one of them, discovering Joanna Macy and her thinking about this. So, you know, once again, language is important. You know, she talks a lot about reframing, which from a Western perspective, we tend to think of primarily cognitively, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so this notion of things are arising, we're trying to actually experience the arising. You know? So there's the reframing of it, which in fact is really important. You know, when I was talking about there's a model, it's important to know, well, what is the model and how is it different than the model I'm normally operating on? You know, this is not a unitary Western model of consciousness. That by itself is just huge, you know. And then keep testing that. Is that true? The way we test it is actually watching our experience. You know, so starting off with the reframing, like, when, you know, I'm angry, as opposed, well, anger is arising. You know, fear is arising. Huge shift. Huge shift. And on the next piece, when you start doing that, it starts pointing your mind into what? Into arising. And then you actually start experiencing the arising and the passing away. And that there's something else, you know. That's, right? Yeah. So this is the way good practice slowly develops.
Seems like kind of what Jerry was saying, too. At that point, you have a choice. You know, anger is arising. At that point, I have a choice to redirect the mind, or to, I don't have to stay with that. Or if I'm angry or I'm hardwired, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
So.
And this is where on part of the description of this, I said, well, we'll talk about what are reasonable expectations with all of this. Okay. So I think one thing that's really important is, you kind of jumped, and I think this is what we tend to do. And it was kind of implicit, but Jerry was saying, well, if I can see it, then I can, your language was make a decision, and my language was make a choice, okay? And there's something else that's absolutely important to realize from an expectation standpoint. Things are going to arise that are too powerful for us to have the ability to make a choice about them. Right? We all know this, right? Okay. But the thing that we don't want to go by is, while it may be so powerful right now, I mean, like in this little moment or the next fight, maybe I can't make a choice, but I may be able to see the arising and passing away, and that it's, you know, depression, or anger, fear, what have you, right? And the seeing of that is the start of everything, okay? In Buddhist practice, that is where wisdom comes from. That's where insight comes from, is from the seeing. So, I mean, I know, I actually, yesterday, I had this experience where I'm working on this big case, big, huge thing for my clients, big project. It affects a lot of people. And we've been kind of plagued by obstacles and difficulties. You know, like on this part of the project, we're very close to the touchdown, and everything looks like, okay, we figured it out. Like everything's coming together. And I go back and look over some old documents about 11 o'clock yesterday morning. And I'm, you know, I'm on my computer, I'm looking at these documents, and this document comes up, and my eye catches this thing. It's like, and, you know, I want to say, what the fuck? You know, like, oh my God, you know, well, that can't be right. You know, I just see my mind going into denial alert. So then I say, okay, like, so I get up, walk around, come back, I really read this document, and it's disastrous. I mean, it just throws like the hugest wrench into the problem and raises like probably 15 new separate, all and every one of them important legal issues. It's just insane. And I have to be truthful that it just knocked me out. I mean, I had this like instantaneous response to that, of it like taking me down, you know? So I really had to fight, I mean, the entire day with not being depressed and like wanting to give up and, you know, fighting off low energy and all this stuff, okay? But I could see it. And that's what eventually, you know, a couple of hours later, allowed me to get out of it. So if I had just been completely lost in it that whole time, I'm sure that I would still be, and I'm not joking, tonight I'd probably still be depressed, because the momentum of that is so powerful, and all of the ideas like, oh my God, and, oh Jesus, and you know, all that stuff, just, you know, your mind becomes chaotic and different. Well, my mind's not in that state. You know, so today I was able to get up and look at it and say, okay, great, okay, there it is. You know, like, how do we make this work, right? Let's do it, okay?
Yeah. So the moral is wait a day?
Yeah, so Jerry says the moral is wait a day. Yeah, but I don't want anybody to go by this. I mean, the seeing is what's important. And frequently, stuff will just be too powerful initially for us to make a choice. And then we feel like, oh, we're doing something wrong, or the practice isn't working, or what. That's a model deficiency. That's not a deficiency in our practice or in us. It's a deficiency in our understanding of the model of how it works. Okay? Yeah. So, okay. So one more, and then we better close it.
I have to ask, how long was it from the time you saw whatever it was on the screen, and you could pull back and say, oh, wait a minute, I get it. This is what's happening to me. Now I'll take a step back.
I saw it really quickly. I knew what was happening. I know that this has happened before. There are a specific set of circumstances where it will tend to happen. And every time, it knocks me out. You know, I keep getting better, but it knocks me out, and I know that. But I was able to know quite quickly what it was, and then the job was to keep knowing it rather than going into denial, checking out, go getting a Grey Goose martini. Okay, so I'd like to thank all of you very much for coming tonight. In a world with so much suffering, we just absolutely cannot undervalue the value of our coming together like this. The fact that we can find people who want to do this kind of work and can share it and feel safe in doing it is just the most invaluable thing. And although it may not seem like it, every time we're mindful, we change in some small way, and that change affects the people around us and keeps going out in this huge circle and into the whole world. So thank you for your practice, and may all of us and all beings be free from suffering.